Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer talks with a young woman who chronicled her journey through cancer treatment through art. First, President Barack Obama is stepping up efforts to gather feedback on reforming health care in America, with town hall sessions planned in several states. While his reform program is still taking shape, health care experts and officials in Kentucky are keeping a close watch on its progress and its potential for the Bluegrass State. Kristen Espelon spoke with the University of Louisville's Associate Vice President of Health Affairs, Shannon Turner, about the kinds of reforms she believes could transform health care in our state.
I think the thing that I'm most intrigued with and frankly excited about would be the money in the stimulus package for health information exchange and technology enhancement. One of the things that people like Hillary Clinton and even in the Bush administration, Secretary Leavitt, really focused on was the efficiency and economy that can be gained through having enhanced technology in healthcare, reduction of medical errors, ease of administration, portability of health information so that, you know, if you're seeing a physician in Louisville and your job moves somewhere else, you can take your health information with you so your provider that's treating you always has everything that they need to know to make sure that you're getting the best care possible.
Everyone seems to want health care for everyone, or at least all children to have coverage, or at least the currently uninsured to have coverage. But the debate seems to be over whether that program should be run by the government. What do you see as some advantages or disadvantages to that?
I can tell you that part of the issue on the government side is not having the locations. Healthcare is actually a pretty regional service. And in government, you know, usually what you're seeing is a centralized location, yet you're managing healthcare for people very far away from you, and it's hard to stay in touch with that community and that region and their needs. So I think that the centralization of government sometimes makes it difficult, and then just the sheer bureaucracy. Nothing in government turns on a dime. You're always writing a regulation, changing a statute, waiting for your budget to be approved. Government isn't nimble, and healthcare changes so rapidly, especially I think with the influx of the billions of dollars that the stimulus package has generated. We're going to see a lot of innovation and a lot of opportunities. Now, one of the benefits, of course, people would see on the government side is consistency. If you have a plan and it's administered by the government, then you're going to get the same thing in Pikeville that you get in Paducah, and you're not going to have regional variation. Some would argue that's a good thing because it levels the playing field. Others would argue that, you know, again, you're taking those regional nuances out of healthcare. On the private industry side, I think that, you know, people are concerned about profits. People are concerned about insurance companies, whether they're truly aimed at getting people needed care, whether they're trying to limit care. And that debate's been around for a long time. And I think that honestly, with the consumer protection laws that are in place now, consumers are pretty protected, and they have mechanisms to voice concerns and complaints. But the payment methodology, and I think this is something that you consistently hear in the healthcare reform debate, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, it really comes down to payment methodology. We have a system that's based on payment for illness. If you're a healthcare provider and you do a really good job at keeping your patients healthy and they're not coming to see you, you have no mechanism to generate money. And one of the things that we need to look at is making sure that all of our incentives are aligned. One local unique example of that is Passport Health Plan, University Healthcare. We pay providers on a capitated model. So they're paid a flat fee per month to deliver care, and they have bonus programs around getting the sorts of health outcomes that we want to see for the Medicaid members in Jefferson County and the 15 surrounding counties. And what this does is it incents a wellness model where providers are paid to move those health indicators. And it's been very successful. Passport Health Plan is the number 9 Medicaid managed care plan in the country. and the only one, quite frankly, that's not in New England, or I think the other one's in California.
And in his speech to Congress earlier this year, President Obama mentioned that he wanted healthcare reform to include investing in preventive care, which I think is partly what you're talking about. Are you aware of any details of how that investment might be made on a broader scale?
In the stimulus bill, there was $650 million set aside for clinical and community-based prevention, and those are going to be competitive grants, and I think that that is the seed money to get people thinking about prevention programs, wellness programs, and, you know, again, I think funding outside of the current healthcare system is critical to get that discussion started. The other thing that I think is particularly interesting in terms of the president's healthcare approach is his deference to Congress. One of the things that happened last week is the president held a meeting, I think it was on the 7th, with about 100 healthcare interested parties and talked about that he wanted to set the guiding principles, that, you know, Congress would ultimately have some ownership and design of the healthcare strategy. And I think that was a little bit of a sea change from what a lot of people expected. I think that when President Obama took office, we were expecting that a very detailed, full-scale plan would be laid out. And I think that the stimulus package money is really setting the stage for innovation. If we can get electronic medical records and we can get health information technology linking the lab to the hospital, to the physician's office, and we can develop some prevention programs that work and show true outcomes, that will be the backbone of a reform system. And I think that, you know, rather than come in and prescribe a system, he's really giving providers and governments and cities and counties the ability to build some infrastructure that will be wrapped into a system. That way, you're not duplicating efforts.
And do you anticipate that U of L will be applying for some of those competitive grants for preventive care?
Oh, absolutely. I think that from the university perspective, we're looking at everything in the stimulus package, and the mayor's office has a healthcare group that meets specifically to look at the healthcare aspects of the stimulus package. I participate in that group. So we've been going through that and seeing what's applicable to our community, what's applicable to our state, and identifying areas that I think we're all going to go after.
WFPL's Kristen Espelon spoke with the University of Louisville's Shannon Turner. Turner is Associate Vice President for Health Affairs. Jennifer Bruner was diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer called Ewing's sarcoma when she was 23. During treatment, she wrote a blog and took photographs, which are part of an exhibit sponsored by the Children's Hospital Foundation called A Bone Fractured Fairy Tale, My Year Lost in Cancer Land. Bruner developed the exhibit working with Emily Johnson, an art therapist at Cosair Children's Hospital, where Bruner received treatment. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Bruner and Johnson about Bruner's experience and the exhibit.
How did you find out that you had cancer?
Well, I had been sick for about 6 months. I was tired all the time. It started out as my face felt numb. I felt this tingling sensation, and then this mysterious bruise appeared and swelling. And I went from doctor to doctor. I went to one doctor for like 3 or 4 months and was misdiagnosed as having a bruise, of all things. And eventually I went to another doctor and had a biopsy. This is after about 6 months of being ill, and was diagnosed with cancer.
How old were you at the time?
I was 23.
And when did you start treatment, and what was that process like?
I started treatment very, very quickly. By that point, I was in a great deal of pain, and I would have pretty much done anything to not be in pain. I was in the hospital getting surgery for what's called a central line, or a chest tube, I mean, just days later. I really didn't have time to think about it.
But you did think about, I guess, the process during the process, in the sense that you've documented it through photographs and art and writing that's now on exhibit. How did you decide to document that, and what was that process like at the beginning, and how did it change during the process?
Honestly, it started out as like a demented scrapbooking idea. like, oh, I have cancer, I'll go make a scrapbook about it. I don't know who does that, but I just thought I would do that. And actually, it was Emily's idea, the art therapist at the hospital. She had seen some of my artwork. When I was in the hospital, I would be bored and I'd want something to do. So I would take pictures or draw or whatever. And she suggested I do an art show. And I thought about it. And I guess what I was going through at the time, like everything I did was about cancer, because that was just my life at that point.
Well, Emily, what do you remember from that time? And is this something that a lot of cancer patients do, especially ones that are artistically inclined?
The first thing I remember about meeting Jennifer was her sharing her writing and artwork with me and just being blown away. But then also I remember saying, what do you think about having an art show? And she was like, really? Is that possible? And
that
was about 7 months ago, I would say, when we first met. And then kind of from that time, we've gone from just thinking about it as a possibility to actually making it happen. I think it would be beneficial to a lot of our patients. You know, one thing art therapy can do is, besides just giving our patients and family something to do, is kind of help them to achieve something when kind of everything in their life has changed. So they're no longer in the role of like a student or someone who's going to seek a job, and they may, you know, they need sort of something to work toward. And I also think being able to photograph and take do artwork and write about it frames it. So something that's so big and difficult for us to understand, it kind of helps just contain it a little bit.
Oh, exactly. It's a fantastic coping mechanism. Just, you know, intellectualizing something and distancing yourself from it.
Well, you had a little bit of experience with that because you had studied art.
Well, I have a writing degree.
Okay.
But it's very much the same thing, the creative process. Again, just the cathartic aspect, I guess, whether it's visual or music or writing, it's all the same, in my opinion.
And how did yours start out? Can you read from your work that's in the exhibit?
Well, one of the issues I had to deal with was menopause, believe it or not, because of chemotherapy. And I wrote a little essay about it. Thanks to cancer, I became a golden girl at 23, probably Sophia. I have gone through the change. I am in menopause and have the hormones of a 60-year-old. In 30-degree weather, I sometimes have the sudden impulse to rip off my clothes, run outside naked, and roll around in the snow. Hot flushes are no joke. I start hyperventilating, sweating, and generally feel like I have just doused myself in gasoline and been lit on fire at a Buddhist peace march. So I guess that I'm one hot menopausal mama.
And this was just one of the trying times in terms of the whole process.
Oh, yes.
What were some of the other things that you had to, I mean, this was towards the end of the process, is that correct?
No.
Or what part was it?
Well, I was in a study for an experimental drug called Lupron. It tells your pituitary gland to stop stimulating your ovaries to produce follicle-stimulating hormone, FSH. So you go into menopause, and the thinking is it will protect your ovaries, and you might have some fertility left. I had a lot of pain issues. That was a very, very big thing. Bone cancer is just very painful. I had a lot of complications from radiation, mucositis, extremely painful. I had multiple infections and fevers. I was on a heart monitor. I think I was in the hospital like 4 or 5 months. I don't really know, somewhere in there. And then, of course, emotionally, just watching your family and your friends and feeling guilty somehow.
Feeling guilty?
Because you see them crying. And you feel like you're responsible for it somehow.
Did that manifest itself in your writing or in the artwork?
Very much so.
How?
Oh, my gosh. Well, in the introductory essay to the exhibit, I talk about that very issue, that feeling of you have to be, I don't know, whenever you see cancer in popular media, it's always like the inspirational story of so-and-so. You look at like a love story, Jenny, or Mandy Moore in A Walk to Remember. Mm-hmm. And it's always these people who are so brave and strong and wonderful. And it's like, if you're not like that, then I don't know, if you show weakness, other people pick up on that and they start to feel hopeless for you, like you're going to die.
That's scary. I mean, just being in that feeling that sense of responsibility when you have to take care of yourself too.
Very much so. It's weird role reversal when you're in your 20s, you know, 23, and just having to feel that way. It's a really surreal feeling.
Did putting together the artwork, the writing, and the pictures, taking the pictures, did that help with that situation?
Very much so. I feel like it humanizes something which is so sterile and medical. People don't tend to think of it in human terms unless it's like pity. Oh, I feel so sorry. Like, you know, you look at people who are victims of genocide, like in Africa. People, it's so terrible. People just tune it out and they don't want to think about it. And they'll just go on their day like they never saw it and it never happened. And if you can put a human face on it, like, look, yes, it is horrible, but we're people too. We're not always crying all the time. You know, some things are funny. We have lives, we have friends, and we're like you. It was kind of cool to share my perspective.
Did you see some people get it when the show opened last week?
Oh, very much so.
How did you see that connection manifest itself?
I just saw a whole spectrum of human emotion. I saw people cry. I saw people laugh. I saw people smirk. Just all sorts of... I could just tell that they weren't there to be looking at the spectacle or to see something interesting that they'd never seen. I mean, they connected on an emotional human level. Like, oh, this is another person. This is their perspective.
Where are you now within treatment or your health now?
Well, I ended treatment in November. Well, I actually ended chemotherapy in October, late October, I think. And I had a surgery to remove my central line in November. My hair has finally started growing back. And I've actually started school and I'm doing really well.
And what are you doing in school now?
I'm studying nursing right now.
And did you already have an undergrad degree before?
I do. My bachelor's is in English with a concentration in writing from Indiana University Southeast.
And then now what are you studying?
I'm doing the second degree accelerated nursing program at U of L.
And what prompted that?
Before I got sick, I wanted to be a speech pathologist. I knew I wanted to do something medical, some sort of helping profession. I chose nursing. I think I want to do something in oncology, probably. I just feel a really deep connection to that, just on a personal level. I feel like I could be helpful and have a perspective. I know when I was in the hospital, there was a nurse who had a child who had been on that floor. And she, honestly, it was all the nurses together, but really her. I just remember one night, I was really sad because somebody in the ward had died. I mean, she just sat up and talked with me for 2 hours. It was really cool. And she just understood. She got it.
Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The exhibit, A Bone Fractured Fairy Tale, My Year Lost in Cancer Land, is showing in downtown Louisville through April 30th at the FB3 Development Building on East Market Street. When we come back, WFPK's Laura Schein talks with Joan Baez. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up a little later in the show, Susan Sweeney Crum talks with a dog behavior specialist. First, the studios and offices of Louisville Public Media were abuzz last week with news of a music legend in the building. WFPK's Laura Schein interviewed Joan Baez. We now share that interview with you.
The new release from Joan Baez is called Day After Tomorrow, produced by Steve Earle. So Steve's on it,
yeah.
Of course.
And they're all Steve's choices because he seems to know just about everybody. So we went to Nashville, which is one of his homes, and he just picked all people he'd worked with. So there wasn't any problem for him choosing.
I'm sure, I bet when Steve Earle asked, they probably step up to the plate and say, sure, I'll do it.
Yeah, definitely.
Some of those artists would be Tim O'Brien, who's just a terrific musician, and then Victor Krause, who's Alison Krause's brother, I believe.
I'm
pretty sure he is. He's a great bass player. And Daryl Scott and Kenny Malone, really stellar list of artists. But Steve Earle, you had actually worked with Steve Earle on an earlier release of yours, hadn't you?
No, he had opened for me on concert tour a few times, and then I'd been at situations where he was getting an award, and I would award it to him. All well-deserved.
But you had covered one of his songs, too.
Yeah, covered a couple of his songs, Christmas in Washington and Jerusalem.
Yeah. I saw on your MySpace page, it was a video of you and Steve. And you all seem to have a really good rapport.
It's really good rapport. I mean, he's about as down to earth as you can get. Mm-hmm. And we both like to work fast. It was really took about maximum 2 weeks to make the whole thing. I came back and did some vocals, but he wasn't interested in perfection at all. So he left, said he was going on tour, and I was left to the perfection part, which, you know, there isn't that much of it. It's really a happy collection of songs and people and biscuits in the morning and coffee and discussion and then the songs, you know.
Did you pick out the songs mainly?
I picked out all the ones except the ones that he wrote.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, like the song you picked out a song by Patty Griffin, mm-hmm. Mary. Was she an artist that you'd been familiar with prior to that?
Yeah. I had known her things. Some of the people I had not known. Some of the songs were naturals, you know, like Day After Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, my assistant called me up and said, there's something you have to hear. She heard it on the internet. And so a song like that is so natural for me that I couldn't learn it overnight because it was, you know, it was complex. But I wrote it all down and sang it in concert as soon as I could. Mm-hmm. So beautiful.
That's a Tom Waits.
Yeah.
Tune. Mm-hmm. And then also an Eliza Gilkison, who is not terribly well known around here, maybe more in the Southwest. I know mm-hmm. she plays in Austin and that kind of thing. How did you find out about her?
Same thing. I mean, mostly it's my manager listens, my assistants listen, my friends listen. I don't pretend to go out beating the bushes myself because I know it'll get to me. And then my job is picking songs out of my, you know, the repertoires of my trusted friends and what they will send me because I know they're at least halfway home. And then I do the rest of the choosing on my own.
Do artists ever send you songs and say, I wish you'd record this? Or
yeah, sometimes.
Has it ever happened where you've done that or?
A couple times. Mostly it goes through the different channels. Mm-hmm. I'm fussy.
What have you been listening to lately?
You asked me earlier, and mm-hmm. I always can never think of who it is, except this time it happens to have been that I've been listening to opera. There's some new people out and singing operas, and I've been listening to them, and my old favorite is Jussi Björling, who's a Swedish tenor. And then I put on a Willie Nelson old favorites about a month ago, and I started to cry, and I just listened to that mm-hmm. for the whole month. It was in the car, and then it was in my room. And
I love Willie Nelson. Yeah. He's got a new album with Asleep at the Wheel. It's all Western swing. It's a really new fun.
I'm ready.
Yeah. I understand that 2008 has marked, or maybe it's 2009, has marked some anniversaries for you.
Well, in 2008, it was the 50th anniversary of the very beginning of my singing at the Club 47, yeah. which is now Passim's, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And 1959 was Newport. My first appearance at Newport. So that was a more official, you know, yeah. huge crowd for me. There were 13,000 people there. I didn't think you could gather that many people in one place at one time. So that was a very big deal. Yeah.
Odetta escorted you to that festival, is that right?
Her husband drove and she took me under her wing. Yeah, absolutely. And she introduced me to people and you know, introduced me to a lot of songs. I think that second round of songs, the first round of songs I knew that weren't, or I learned that weren't rhythm and blues, were all Harry Belafonte songs. And right after that, it was all Odetta songs. I mean, everything she did that I could do with my ukulele and then guitar, yeah. I did, yeah.
So she had a pretty profound influence on
you. She had a huge influence on me. I mean, there wasn't just that her singing and her voice. It was that there was something very solid there and something very meaningful. And then it moved on, including after her and including her, and then it was Pete Seeger.
Mm-hmm. I got to see Odetta play once. It was one of the most amazing concerts I'd ever seen. It wasn't her exclusively. There were other people on the bill. But I remember she started from the very back of an auditorium, mm. and the lights were out, and you just heard this incredibly haunting voice. Mm. I'll never forget it. It gave me chills. I was just so taken with her. And I wasn't really aware of who she was, but after that night, I certainly was, you know.
He had a tendency to remember. She was a powerhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then with this strange little sensitivity that would come in about the songs that she chose and wherever she went during that song, I mean, we had no idea. And then we would each take our own direction when she was singing.
Well, she passed away recently.
Right.
May she rest in peace. She left behind just some amazing, amazing music.
You're listening to Studio 619 on WFPL, and Laura Shine of WFPK is interviewing Joan Baez.
We've been talking some about Odetta, her early beginnings in the music world, and also the new album, which is called Day After Tomorrow. It's produced by Steve Earle, who also contributes a couple of tracks to this new record. I understand you also played at Obama's inauguration?
I sang at one of the balls. I sang it was called a peace ball. I guess it seems like a natural, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very new to me and very strange. I've never had anything to do with party politics.
Mm-hmm.
Don't like them for the most part. And then there was an extraordinary thing that happened with this man. You know, and I went into endorsing him with a total understanding that there would be lots of things I would not like about his job and the things that he had to do. And as a pacifist, dealing at whichever point with a commander-in-chief of the Army, Navy, and Air Force would be somewhat of a conflict for me. But anybody running for president who has The Life of Gandhi in his top 10 favorite books, who not only is willing to but wants to talk to leaders of countries that we think are bad, bad, bad countries. I mean, what a concept. Who kept saying, share the wealth, which is supposed to be such a terrible thing to say. Can't think of anything better to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the face of this ridiculous response to it by so many people kept saying it, you know, there's such room for reintroducing the idea of sacrifice, reintroducing real compassion. It just seemed the possibilities are endless. And I think what he is walking into is so monstrously difficult that he needs the support of all of us who feel of like mind about what could happen to all of us, to the country, and to the world.
Did you get to witness the actual ceremony of his coming?
I did. I was wandering around under the labyrinth of the Capitol, and then outside, and we had our yellow card and joined the yellow line, and we looked at the yellow line. It was about 4 miles long, so we pulled out my name to see what we could do with it, and some very kind, very right-wing senator said, oh, let me help you, and got us a red card, which got us way, way up in back of him.
Wow.
So when I looked out in front of me, there were probably a million people. Most extraordinary thing I've ever seen in my life, you know. And I was allowing myself to just be snowed by by everything with no reservations at all. And as a result, I simply wept through the whole thing.
Wow.
I mean, I tried to applaud here and there, and I would just break down and weep.
Yeah, it was such a moving moment. I don't remember ever crying at an inauguration before.
I've never watched one.
Yeah, oh, right,
yeah.
Right. Or even an election, you know, yeah. It was just incredibly moving. Did you, election night, when you found out that he had won, there's a little story about how you and maybe some other folks went out in front of the White House.
Well, it was my band and I and some of the crew. We were all dressed in zebra robes because we were staying at a hotel that had a jungle motif. And when we actually got over the shock of realizing that he had been nominated, we just stood there. We were in a hotel room that you can't stand there. You can't stay in the room. So we went traipsing downstairs, Alexandria, Virginia, not a soul on the street. So we got a cab and said, take us to the White House. And the closer we got, the more unbelievable and marvelous and surreal it got, with the slap me fives and the jumping in and out of cabs and hollering and yelling and hugging. And I guess we were a few of the 4,000 people out in front of the White House. And I've never seen a more well-meaning crowd. It was hard to keep people from singing unpleasant things to the outgoing president. But even that seemed, you know, not that hostile.
Yeah. And I would imagine just the feelings in that crowd had to be amazing.
You know, probably the thing that will stand out for me forever on the day that we all went in to the Capitol was really the day on the subway, in the subway car, of the subway car being filled with people who had never seen each other before, of all races, hugging and singing and embracing. And it was symbolic of everything on that day, of Inauguration Day. And it stood out more than anything else because it was so real. It was right there for all of us in that room to enjoy.
I understand you also sang for some volunteers at the Obama headquarters in Alexandria.
Yeah.
Was that kind of a surprise thing for them? Or
well, one of my musicians had gone over on the day of and had gone with some instruments and played and actually had made phone calls and worked with them. Mm-hmm. And then he suggested in the evening, well, why don't we go over there? And just because they all looked so tired. Mm. And they were so tired. They'd been up for day and night for ages. So we just went and sang a bunch of songs. Yeah, it was nice.
What a thrill that must have been for them, too, I'm sure. You also, this past year, stood on stage with Nelson Mandela for his 90th birthday.
Yeah.
And that was in London's Hyde Park?
Yeah, that was wonderful.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, this man, he had all his senses. He had all his wits about him. Mm-hmm. And we had a dinner with him the night before with all the faldera and all the celebrity. And he just sat there and poked around at his dinner and watched and said a few things. Because everybody's hanging on every word, so he doesn't have to say more than about a sentence. And the next day was the big do for him. Yeah. Thousands and thousands of people. The same thing. He stood. He's very frail. Mm-hmm. And his face looks like the face in the posters we've seen for decades. Mm-hmm. It's just that he's frail and smaller and just as intelligent.
What did you sing that day?
I think I sang, I sang a duet, and I can't remember his name right now. I've sung his song, Asimbonanga, half in English and half in a dialect from South Africa, Johnny Clegg.
Oh, Johnny Clegg.
And then that's all I sang.
Mm.
You're listening to an interview between Laura Shine of WFPK and music legend Joan Baez in Studio 619 on WFPL.
So what's next for you? You're touring right now. Is this going to be a long tour for you? Or?
Well, the one I'm on right now is a month and a half, month and a half to 2 months. And then I'll go out some in the summertime and I'll go out again in the fall. And in the meantime, or during this time, I'm making a documentary.
Oh.
It's time.
Yeah, about your life? Is that what it's going to be?
Yeah.
And who's filming that?
Well, it's American Masters.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. And it's taking the form of conversation. Most of it is me having conversations with people to try to make it slightly different from the talking heads. A lot of it is also interviews, but it's more interesting in some ways to just have me chatting with people like my ex-husband about that whole time period of resistance. Julia Butterfly about sitting in a tree, Vaclav Havel about the revolution in what was then Czechoslovakia. Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Browne, we just sat and talked. They have an interviewer there, but he didn't have to ask questions a lot of the time, and my father, when he was young, was a camera buff. He had an 8mm camera, and he got tons of things on moving film. And then he handed the camera to other people. For instance, you see him and my mother leaving the church when they got married.
Wow.
These extraordinary things like that. So I haven't seen it yet. It's been roughly put together, and I haven't seen it yet.
Do you know an air date for it, when it's supposed
to? Well, we're hoping to have it out in the fall.
Oh, that's exciting.
Next fall, yeah.
Excellent. I can't wait to see that. Did your dad get much footage of you as a kid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of footage of all three of us kids.
What about the first performance at Club 47?
There's footage of, he didn't take it, but somebody took it, and all this is sort of appearing from different people. There's extraordinary film of me singing in Club 47. Wow. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, that's going to be fun to see again, don't you think?
I'll probably take a sheet with me to cry into. Yeah. It just went from an hour and a half to 2 hours. There's too much to cover.
Wow. You've been performing for 50 years.
Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy. What do you still get out of it? What continues to surprise you or amaze you, or does anything surprise you or amaze you anymore?
It amazes me that I still do it. It amazes me that people still come to listen to it. It amazes me that it's much more fun now. It wasn't fun for many years for the most part.
Why?
I was a kid, and I was neurotic, and I was plagued by lots of phobias and insomnia and all the stuff that people didn't know about because I looked so calm. Mm-hmm. I was paying for it off stage. And then little by little, and I must say I owe what peace I have now, which is a great deal, to years of hard work and therapy, mm-hmm. that without that anyway, I would not be at this stage in my life able to just walk on stage and sing for the joy of singing and for other people's joy. That's an extraordinary thing, and that amazes me.
Do you think performing plays a number on people's head, or can it? I mean, is that kind of what happens to some people, or to you in your
case?
Well,
hopefully I wouldn't put it that way.
Yeah.
Hopefully I would say I re-experience, I'm shooting off the top of my head right now, but I'm re-experiencing the songs, probably in different ways on different nights. I experience the audiences all differently. And I mean, to the point where I think, aha, I know this public because I've been to a place before, even the same hall. And often it has nothing to do with what it was like the time before. Mm-hmm. So the trick is to not have expectations. I always do anyway, but mm-hmm. they always get shot down, you know, and to make as much as possible to make a community out of that room with myself, my band, and the people. Mm-hmm. That sometimes is a trick, and sometimes it's absolutely simple, and a lot of that depends on the public.
Yeah. I guess my question's a little bit more aimed at thinking about how I see a lot of performers that tend to get caught up in something. I'm not sure what that is. They end up, you know, their lives kind of falling apart. The more success, the more fame they get, it seems like there can be a curse to it. You talked about how therapy has mm-hmm. helped you and kept you sane throughout this process, but mm-hmm. I guess what I'm wondering is what's the insane making factor of that, do you think?
Well, for me, I had a foundation early on. The foundation was in probably starting with my family becoming Quakers when I was 8 years old. So the whole foundation had to do with violence, nonviolence, and my family opted for nonviolence, including my father, who, instead of going to make a whole lot of dough with the military, he started to, and he couldn't stand it. Mm. So, in fact, that is when he quit. Anything to do with the money, the only money-making time that our family ever had was when my dad did try out. His friends said, you know, you got to try this out. And he did, and he didn't like it at all, so he quit. And that was the end of that, was the end of that time in our history. And so from that, you know, I went forward from that point with ideals that formed my foundation. And for whatever reason, that took. Doesn't mean it will always take, but it did take. And somehow, I mean, we ended up in Baghdad when I was 10 years old. My father was with UNESCO. My mother gave me the Diary of Anne Frank. Huge, huge thing in my life. Mm-hmm. I was about her age when I read that book.
And Frank's age. Yeah.
And I saw people suffering in a way that if I'd stayed home in California with my friends, I never would have seen before. And again, that took, it was like a vaccine mm-hmm. For me to see another world. Many years later, when I was already steeped in reading and studying Gandhi, I met Dr. King. Martin Luther King came to speak at our high school.
Wow.
And so I was 16. He was probably about 29, something like that. So it was another big event in my life. And so I had all of that before I really was, quote, even well known. Mm-hmm. And so, and plus that when I became well known, I was afraid of it. I was afraid of the commercial world, which worked to my advantage because I stayed shy of it. And so I didn't get caught up in the things that I could have gotten caught up in. And I didn't do drugs. Mm-hmm. That was the other thing most people don't know because it's assumed that everybody during that time period did drugs.
Right.
And I didn't. So that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, being the sober one at the party.
Yeah, being the dull one over in the corner. Plus, I didn't go to parties either. I mean, I was really a square.
You seem to have been at all these pivotal moments in history too. I mean, Obama's inauguration, Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday, and then the things that you just talked about, having Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at your high school.
Yeah.
What an extraordinary life.
Yes, it has been an extraordinary life. When I look back at the book I wrote in some 86 or something, I get exhausted looking at it. I don't know how I did all that stuff, you know, but I did it. I'm glad I did it all.
Yeah. And you're still doing stuff.
I'm still doing stuff. You know, it's important to say right now, though, that I'm putting a lot of energy into my family. I didn't do that in the 60s and 70s. And I get a chance now to really to know my son. I get a chance to watch my mom get old. She's 95, and she's teaching me a lot just by, you know, her strength and determination. And she's ornery as hell, you know, which is a good thing. She said the other day, she's not afraid of dying. The other day she said, well, maybe the very last second I might get scared. So, wow.
Is she in pretty good health?
She's in excellent health.
Great. Yeah. And how old's your son?
My son's 39 and my granddaughter's 5.
Fun. Is she your one and only grandchild?
Yeah. My one and only son. So there's the other thing. I might not want to miss that 5-year-old.
Yeah. You're getting to spend a lot of time with her?
Yeah, they live about an hour and a half away, which means they're not threatened by my presence. But it turns out to be that they actually want me to come visit. So.
Very nice.
That was music legend Joan Baez talking with Laura Shine of our sister station, WFPK. When we come back, Susan Sweeney Crum talks with a canine behavior specialist. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Is your dog a little on the wild side, even beyond the puppy stage? When you're out for a stroll, who's actually walking whom? If your favorite canine is in need of some training, you might want to consider a special session this coming weekend with Sam Malatesta. A Canadian trainer some might call a dog whisperer specializes in dogs with behavior problems. Susan Sweeney Crum spoke with him about the upcoming seminar and how owners can benefit from the training as much as the pets.
Now, when you're here for your seminars, what will you be doing?
Well, I start off with trying to teach people who they're supposed to be to their dog. Now, we really got to watch words here because it could be a little misconception when I say dominant. There's dominant benevolence, and then there's dominant domineering. And a lot of people out there believe that dominant is a domineering thing, pinning them down, holding them down, being a little harsh and that. No, dominant means that you are self-assured and strong and know where you're going and you understand your subject and you get your subject to want to work with you. I basically put people in the concept that we're human, dogs are dogs, and we actually have to see what they see in order to get them to see what we want. If we just focus on what we feel comfortable as a human being that's good for dogs, 9 times out of 10, it's the exact opposite.
Hmm.
So in the time of fear, let's say, or even aggression, the biggest habit with a lot of people is a couple of things. One is they get anxious or worried about the dog's behavior or worried about what the dog's going to do. Well, leadership isn't that. Leadership is staying even keel and absolutely calm, and you think it through. Don't focus on what the dog's going to do. Focus on getting the dog out of it. The other piece of dominance, or what people do, is that they try to soothe the dog or acknowledge the dog in bad behavior. I tell people, don't be patient, stay calm, wait for the good behavior to come. I show them how to set it up. When it comes, praise them. This way you don't give a double acknowledgement. So I'll get people that say, no, stop that, to a dog that's being bad. Well, to the dog, that's still an acknowledgement. Mm. Instead, I'll do something like, say, what are you doing? Come over here. Change it, redirection. Dog sits down happy. Good dog.
Mm.
I'll walk a dog and work in an exercise. And if the dog is walking, I don't ask it to look at me or try to get pay attention to me. I will wait patiently till it does look at me, and then I will acknowledge it.
Hmm.
So I'll give back a dog exactly what it's giving me. So if it doesn't give me anything, I'm not apt to be impatient of it trying to give it to me. I'll just wait patiently for the dog to do it. And my philosophy is this: they don't live as long as we do. So I'm more patient than they are. I've got a lot more time. So that's the key to what we really do.
Your T-shirt says, read what that says to me. It
says, your dog will look at you when you're worth looking at. And I really believe in that philosophy. I mean, I think we picked that up a couple years ago. And I said this to a person, your dog won't look at you because it doesn't think it's worth it or you're worth it. And in all honesty, when you really think about that, people will look at each other when we all have something valid to say. And we will pay attention when there's validity in the conversation. When there's not, we're looking at the ground trying to get out of here. Well, if you watch a lot of dogs that are walking the sidewalks, they're sniffing the ground. They will look at a pole. They will look at the cat across the road or the kid. Meanwhile, the owner's standing there trying to say something, and the dog doesn't pay attention. So that's not something that the dog did. That's something we did to that dog. And sometimes we indirectly make the dog more important than we are. And once something knows that, then your conflict begins, because you'll see people where they dote over them. They put a lot of attention into them. My God, the dog's not happy and all this stuff. And that's our human side. But when you really, really look at a dog that's getting all that love and attention, it's all great and wonderful. But now look at the dog and see if it really cares about it. It's the reverse. The dog is supposed to care about you. And dogs need people of strength around them. And that's what I do with people. And I'm not saying that people that have dogs with trouble aren't strong. I'm saying that they're just not strong in the equation of that relationship. It's incredibly emotional for people and their dogs. And really, the hard part about it is getting people to understand you got to take the emotion out of it to be able to help you both through and think objectively. That's half the battle.
Well, what does make us worth looking at?
Well, if you understand the way the dog ticks, okay, I basically teach in the concept of mother dog. So if you look at a mom dog who is the dominant figure to a puppy, puppies never take their eyes off of their mom. And I've managed to put together something called a whelping box theory, which basically puts you in the realm of how a mom thinks. And she acknowledges at a certain time. So you'll see, I'll give you an example in the time of birth, a puppy that's crying and does not come to mom. As humans, when we get puppies and any of that, we go to them. A mom doesn't do that. She does the opposite. You come to me and I'll acknowledge you. So these are the things that we do. And then she'll gauge how much time that they get. So you'll see a mom feed for 5 or 10 minutes, and then the puppies will finish and crawl away into another smaller box. Well, what people do with puppies when they first get them, or any new dog, the dog's in a heightened apprehensive state, and you're giving it all this attention because it's a novelty for us. We just got this new dog, and we worry about it being happy. A mother dog worries and only focuses on giving the puppy independent strength to survive without her. People tend to go the opposite and saying, I get strength from my dog, in a lot of cases of people that I meet. And it's really about giving that dog strength to walk with you, to be in handling it outside. So you'll get a lot of dogs that are absolutely wonderful in the home, but the minute they walk on the sidewalk, nothing exists. That's because you made them so important. You're constantly going to them. Is he eating? I've seen people spoon feed. I've seen people give dogs the ultimate reward of life, like right away on the bed. And all these things are wonderful. But I earned my privileges and gifts of life because I've worked hard. And I'm sure everybody in this room has. For some reason with dogs, we give them everything without having to work. Now, if you take that dog out of the equation and did that to a child, what would you have when it grows up?
A spoiled, rotten.
You wouldn't be worth looking at as a parent. So it's about putting it in a perspective of knowing when to pat, knowing when to acknowledge, knowing how to raise them. And when you truly know something or somebody, they'll look at you instinctually and they'll follow you everywhere. So it's really about gaining the dog's respect by knowing what the dog is all about. And that's basically what I teach.
The weekend training session runs from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. this Saturday and from 10 to 4 on Sunday. You can register by visiting Sam Malatesta's webpage at whosthedog.net. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.